Have you ever really stopped to think about what makes a society fair? Like, is it just about everyone getting the exact same slice of the pie?
Or is it maybe something a bit more nuanced than that?
Exactly. So in this deep dive, we're going to explore how governments try to tackle inequality, promote fairness in how income and wealth get distributed.
Yeah, and we've got some really interesting sources lined up today. Detailed notes, summaries, they really help distinguish between key ideas like equity and equality.
And different kinds of poverty too,
Right,
right?
different kinds of poverty, and also how various policies try to strike that balance between being fair and keeping the economy productive.
And this isn't just theory, is it? Understanding this stuff really helps you grasp what's going on in economic debates, how policies actually impact people's lives.
Absolutely. It's about getting to the heart of what drives these efforts to create a more just society for everyone.
Okay, so let's unpack this first big one, equity versus equality. You hear them used, well, almost like they mean the same thing
They
sometimes.
really do get mixed up.
But in economics, they're fundamentally different. So could you maybe kick us off with equality? What does that mean here?
Sure. So equality in this context really means giving everyone the very same resources or opportunities. It doesn't really matter what your individual situation is.
Okay, like a one-size-fits-all approach.
Exactly. Think about giving out money. An equality approach might be giving, say, $1,000 a month to every single person. Period. Rich, poor, doesn't matter.
Uniform treatment. Got it.
Yeah. Policy-wise, it promotes that uniformity.
Okay, so if equality is about sameness, giving everyone the identical thing, how does equity come into it? How's that different?
Well, equity shifts the focus to fairness. And crucially, it takes into account that people start from different places. They have different needs, different abilities, different obstacles.
Ah, so it's not one size fits all.
Not at all. Equity is about distributing resources specifically to help level the playing field, to support those who are disadvantaged.
So going back to your money example.
Right. An equity-based policy wouldn't give everyone $1,000. It might give that $1,000, maybe even more, to low-income households, but perhaps less or even nothing to high-income households.
Because the goal is different.
The goal is a just outcome. It's about compensating for those underlying inequalities to give people a fairer shot. It's why distinguishing between them is so critical when you're designing policy.
Okay, that distinction is clear now. Equality is sameness, equity is fairness based on need. But here's where it gets really interesting, right? Because trying to achieve that fairness, that equity, can sometimes clash with, well, keeping the economic engine running at full speed.
Ah, yes. The classic equity efficiency trade-off.
Exactly. So before we get into the trade-off itself, what do economists actually mean by economic efficiency?
Okay, so in simple terms, economic efficiency means we're using our resources in the smartest way possible, getting the most output, making consumers as satisfied as possible, without any waste.
No waste. Sounds good.
Yeah, and there's sort of two sides to it. Allocative efficiency, making sure stuff goes where it's most valued, and productive efficiency, making things at the lowest possible cost.
Both sound pretty desirable. So where does the clash, the trade-off with equity come in?
Well, the tension arises because many policies designed to boost equity think higher taxes on the wealthy to fund social programs, for instance.
Okay.
Those policies can sometimes reduce the incentive for people to work harder or to save or maybe invest in a new business.
Right, because they keep less of the extra income they might generate.
Precisely. So take a progressive tax system. It definitely helps reduce income inequality, which is an equity goal. But some argue it could discourage high earners from putting in that extra effort, potentially leading to slightly lower overall economic output. That's the efficiency side potentially taking a hit.
But it's not always that simple, is it? Because surely having massive inequality can also be bad for the economy overall.
Absolutely. That's the crucial counterpoint. While we talk about this trade-off, it's vital to recognize that extreme inequality itself can seriously harm long-term efficiency.
How so?
Well, think about it. If large parts of your population can't access decent education or healthcare, or even just the capital to start a small business, you're wasting potential.
You're limiting the talent pool.
You're limiting the talent pool, you're stifling innovation, you're reducing the overall productive capacity of the entire society. So it's not a simple case of equity good, efficiency bad, or vice versa.
It's a balancing act.
It really is.
Wow.
Public policy is almost always trying to find that sweet spot, creating a fairer society without, completely stalling economic growth. and vice versa.
Okay, so navigating that balance often involves understanding poverty more deeply. And it's not just a simple poor or not poor label, is it?
No, not at all. There are different ways to define poverty, and they tell us quite different things.
Let's start with absolute poverty. What's that about?
Absolute poverty is defined by a fixed, unchanging standard. It's about whether you have enough income or resources to meet the absolute basic needs for survival food, basic clothing, shelter.
Like a minimum threshold for existing?
Exactly. If your income falls below that line, you're considered in absolute poverty.
Yeah.
The World Bank uses a figure, like currently around $2.15 a day, adjusted for what that money can actually buy in different places.
And the key thing is it's universal.
Yes. It's meant to be comparable across countries. It's fundamentally about survival.
Okay, that makes sense. Survival. So how does relative poverty contrast with that?
Relative poverty shifts the benchmark. It's not about a fixed survival line. It's defined in relation to the average or median income within a particular society.
So it depends on the country you're in.
Very much so. You might be considered relatively poor if your income is significantly lower than the typical income in your society, even if you can technically afford basic food and shelter.
Give me an example.
Sure. In many developed European countries, for example, the relative poverty line is often set at something like 60% of the median national income. If you earn less than that, you're considered relatively poor.
So what does relative poverty tell us that absolute poverty doesn't?
It tells us about inequality within that society. It highlights the gaps, the disparities. It's less about just surviving day to day and more about social inclusion, about opportunity, about whether you can participate fully in the life of your community.
So it's about more than just basic needs. It's about participation, social standing.
Exactly. One definition focuses on pure survival, the other on societal integration and fairness within a specific context. Both are important, but they highlight different challenges.
Okay, understanding those different types of poverty brings us to another really tricky concept. Sometimes well-meaning policies can actually create a sort of trap.
You're talking about the poverty trap.
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? Helping people could trap them. How does that work?
It's a really critical concept, and unfortunately, quite real for many. The poverty trap is basically a situation where individuals or families just can't seem to escape poverty, often because the system itself creates barriers.
Barriers like what?
Specifically, it often relates to how welfare benefits interact with earned income. Imagine someone on benefits gets a job or increases their hours.
Which is what you want, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
But as their earned income goes up, their benefits, things like housing support, food aid, maybe childcare help start getting withdrawn.
Ah, I see. So the extra money they earn is canceled out.
It can be, yes. The net financial gain from working more can become tiny. Or sometimes even negative. They might end up with barely more money, or even less, in their pocket after working harder, once taxes and benefit withdrawal are factored in.
So there's just no real incentive to push for that slightly higher paying job or work more hours.
Exactly. It creates a massive disincentive. It's not about people being lazy. It's about the structure of the system, making it economically irrational, in some cases, to earn more beyond a certain point.
And that leads to long-term dependency.
It can, yes. It reduces social mobility, keeps people stuck. And think about the wider the loss potential, the innovation that doesn't happen because people are held back.
It's a huge challenge for policymakers then, designing systems that help but don't trap.
It's incredibly difficult. How do you provide a safety net and ensure there's always a clear financial benefit to working more, saving more, and moving up?
Right. It's clear there's no magic bullet for these problems. But governments do have a range of tools, policies they try to use. Let's maybe talk through some of those.
Sure. There's quite a toolkit, each with its own pros and cons.
What about something like the negative income tax? I've heard that mentioned. Sounds a bit unusual.
Yeah, the NIT. It was famously proposed by economist Milton Friedman, actually. The basic idea is pretty straightforward, maybe a bit counterintuitive at first.
Okay.
Instead of people below a certain income level paying income tax, the government actually pays them.
So it reverses the flow below a certain line.
Exactly. If there's an income threshold, say $20,000, and you earn $15,000, the government might pay you a portion of that $5,000 difference.
And the thinking is that this helps with the poverty trap we just discussed.
That's a major goal. It aims to create a smoother transition from welfare to work, ensuring there's always some benefit to earning an extra dollar, unlike the potential sharp cutoffs you see with some means-tested benefits.
Okay, that makes sense. What about universal benefits? That sounds simpler.
It is simpler in concept. Universal benefits are given to all citizens or all residents, regardless of their income or need.
Like what kind of things?
Classic examples are things like universal child benefits paid per child, or free public education for everyone, or maybe state pensions that everyone gets after a certain age.
What are the upsides there? Seems fair in a way. Everyone gets it.
The big advantages are simplicity. They're usually easier and cheaper to administer than checking everyone's income. And there's no stigma attached, because everyone, rich or poor, receives them.
But the downside must be cost, right? Giving money or services to everyone, even the wealthy.
That's the major drawback.
Yeah.
They can be incredibly expensive for the government. Which leads us to the opposite approach.
Which would be?
Means-tested benefits. These are the ones you only get if you can prove your income or assets are below a certain level.
So things like food stamps or unemployment benefits where you have to qualify based on low income?
Exactly. Subsidized housing, certain types of welfare payments, they are specifically targeted.
And the advantage there is obviously cost effectiveness. You're only helping those who demonstrably need it.
Right. They direct resources where the need is greatest, which is efficient from a government budget perspective.
I'm guessing this brings us back towards the poverty trap issue.
It certainly can. Because benefits are withdrawn as income rises, means-tested systems are often the ones that create those high effective marginal tax rates, the disincentives to earn more. Plus, they involve eligibility checks, administration, potential stigma.
Complexity. Okay. And one more that gets talked about a lot these days. Universal Basic Income. UBI.
Ah, yes, UBI. It's gained a lot of traction in discussions, particularly around automation and the future of work.
So how does UBI work?
It's quite simple, conceptually. A regular, fixed amount of money paid to every single adult citizen, no strings attached, regardless of whether you're working, your income level, anything.
Everyone gets a basic floor.
That's the idea. The main goal is often framed as eliminating poverty outright and providing fundamental financial security for everyone.
What are the arguments for it, besides poverty reduction?
Proponents say it would drastically reduce welfare stigma, could simplify the existing welfare bureaucracy, maybe even encourage entrepreneurship or education by giving people a safety net to fall back on while they try something new.
And the arguments against, I imagine, cost is number one again.
Absolutely enormous potential cost for governments.
Yeah.
That's the biggest hurdle. And then there are the concerns, similar to some other benefits, about whether it might reduce the motivation to work for some people if their basic needs are covered.
So a real mix of potential upsides and downsides across all these tools. And IT, universal, means-tested, UBI.
Definitely. And it really raises that core question, which tool, or maybe which combination of tools, is the best fit for a particular society's goals? And how do you design it so it actually works as intended without causing, you know, unexpected negative consequences?
It really does underscore the complexity, doesn't it? We've covered a lot of ground here looking at how central equity in income and wealth is for policy, aiming for that social justice and poverty reduction.
Been clarifying that crucial difference. Equality focusing on sameness, while equity really prioritizes fairness, acknowledging different needs and starting points.
And constantly bumping up against that trade-off with economic efficiency.
Right. Managing that tension carefully is key for sustainable development. All these policies we discussed, NIT, UBI, the different benefit types, they're all attempts to navigate that complex landscape.
So maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over after this deep dive based on everything we've discussed.
Yeah. How do you think policymakers can best thread that needle?
How can they design systems that are genuinely fair, that support people, but are also economically efficient and really foster long-term opportunity and growth for absolutely everyone?
It's the multi-trillion dollar question, really. No easy answers.
Definitely not. But hopefully exploring these concepts gives you a better framework for thinking about it. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into such a crucial and complex topic.